You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here.
Who'd have thought it? The next big thing is here. It's Past Prologue back for another awesome event. Isn't that right, Dr. Finn Pollard?
It is. We've had a slight hiatus, but we have pulled ourselves together and ready to roll.
We're just time machines working through the whole range of the universe, etc. And it's the Anonymous that you're considering today with a trio of terrific individuals. Would you like to just mention them by name and then we'll introduce them after the first Billy Joel track?
I will. We have Tom Bishop, John Fitzgibbons and Jason Whittaker. So you may find that there were one or two events in American history referenced in that song that we may come back to later in the conversation. So the jumping off for Past Prologue this time was back in early September, the publication in the New York Times of an anonymous editorial from alleged to be from a member of the White House staff, raising all sorts of questions about the way that Donald Trump was conducting himself in the office of the presidency. And it seemed a good moment to think about the history of anonymity and the press, perhaps particularly with relation to different political regimes. So I'm joined today to do that by Dr. John Fitzgibbons, who's an early modernist in the School of History and Heritage, Dr. Tom Bishop, an Americanist from the School of History and Heritage, and Professor Jason Whittaker, who is the head of the School of English and Journalism. And I'm going to start by talking to John. So I thought it would be useful to start off if you could say a bit about the kind of nature of print culture in your period, so that people can get a sort of sense of the kind of world we're thinking about.
Okay, yeah. So I work on the early modern period, as you just said, which it sits somewhere between the medieval and the modern. No one's really sure where it is, to be honest. But it's in that period that print is actually invented, print's developed, print is used as a medium for the first time. So obviously we get the Gutenberg press invented in Germany in the 15th century. And then by the 16th, 17th century, we get this thing called the print revolution. So we get a massive ramping up of printed output. And what we see is that quite a lot of the books coming off the press in that period are printed anonymously. So you get really lengthy title pages that have got, you know, paragraph long kind of titles explaining the contents of the book, but it doesn't have the author on the cover.
Could you say something about the reasons why it's evolving in that way?
So, I mean, the most obvious reason why people don't put their names on the cover in the Tudor and Stuart period is because of the repercussions if you're printing something that could be seen as dangerous or subversive by the government. This is a time when you could be hanged, drawn and quartered for printing something treasonous, or burnt at the stake for printing something that is seen as heretical. So that's the kind of most obvious reason why people don't put their names on books in this period. But there are other kind of cultural reasons why people don't put their names on print in this period. One of them is that historians claim that there's something of a stigma maybe attached to printing in this period, meaning that people of kind of high class birth don't put their names on books because it's seen as something that's kind of low born to kind of write and to print your work. So they print things anonymously if they do print at all. And it's out of that idea that some kind of crazy conspiracy theories have come about Shakespeare not actually writing Shakespeare. So William Shakespeare didn't write his plays, according to some conspiracy theorists. It was actually a guy called Edward de Vere, who was the Earl of Oxford. And because, you know, modesty dictates that you don't, if you're a nobleman, you don't put your name on print, he actually prints under the pseudonym of William Shakespeare. So, you know, it's a sound theory, but the only fly in the ointment with that is about a dozen of Shakespeare's plays are written after the Earl of Oxford dies. So, you know, it's not really true. Another reason why we don't have names on the title pages of books in this period is because it's a literary strategy as well. It's actually seen as a way in which to prove that your kind of arguments, the contents of your books, are true. You know, that they're worthy. You don't put your name on the book in order to kind of prejudice the reader for or against the work. So you print it anonymously and let the contents of the book kind of speak for themselves. Or you print it pseudonymously. You put a kind of pseudonym on the book, such as Tom Telltruth, for instance, is a popular name that's used to print books under at this time. Finally, another reason that kind of links back to, I'm sure, some of the stuff other speakers are going to speak about today, is that things were printed anonymously in the Tudor period in particular because they were leaked by the government of the time, by government officials at the time. And we see that in particular during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. in the later 16th century. Now, Queen Elizabeth was a woman who knew her own mind. She wouldn't take the advice of her counsellors. So, for instance, she wouldn't take her counsellor's advice over her marriage. She refused to marry, despite her counsellors pleading with her to do so. Also, she wouldn't have her cousin, Mary, Queen of Scots, executed, despite her counsellors wanting to get rid of Mary. So what a number of her counsellors do is they start to actually commission or write their own works and print them anonymously, putting out their own kind of policy arguments, basically, saying what the Queen should do. They actually try to appeal to the public or the literate public at the time to show what their arguments are and to show the unreasonableness of Queen Elizabeth in not taking their advice. Now, ultimately, it doesn't really work. The Queen still continues to do what she wants. But what we can see here is the beginnings, I think, of something that we could call the kind of public sphere. You know, political debates going on outside of the corridors of power at Westminster.
How big is the sort of potential audience they can appeal to at this time? And I'm wondering how high are sort of the literacy levels? Is there quite a lot of regional variation?
I'd say that it's about 30% of all adult males can read and write in this period. For women, it's much lower. It's about 10% of all women can read and write. And obviously, literacy rates get higher the higher up the social order you go. So the sorts of people that these publications are appealing to primarily are the rich, are the literate. They're the people who supposedly are the people that matter at the time, the kind of magnates in the regions in particular, who they're appealing to.
And do you think there are particular reasons why, you know, this strategy doesn't work, you know, particularly when they're trying to influence Elizabeth, say, and as you say, it obviously it doesn't really bear fruit. Mm. Can you say anything about the reasons for that?
Well, it's quite a dangerous strategy to employ anyway, because by appealing to the public, you kind of open up that debate to public opinion. What you end up with is that people start to answer those publications too. And it starts to open up a debate about what policy should be, and people feel like they should be able to have a say on that. So quite quickly, it backfires on these privy councillors, and they start to try and close down that debate quite quickly. So a lot of these tracts are then kind of called back in pretty soon afterwards.
So they don't anticipate the consequences, and it's actually there's a danger of power passing out of elite hands into, or at least more wider than they would like.
So yeah, print's very much a kind of double-edged sword in this period, I think.
And do you get any sort of phenomenon with, because obviously now often there's a kind of, if someone publishes anonymously, there's a sort of hunt for the identity of the author and an attempt to to expose that, and something doesn't seem to be confined actually just to politics now. I mean, you've had it with the Elena Ferrante novels and the attempt to identify her. Is there an attempt to sort of pursue these authors and reveal their identities?
There are in some cases, and censorship in this, I mean, there is no such thing as a real kind of censorship clampdown in this period, because you just don't have the police to kind of enforce that. But they do go after the kind of more prominent authors, the more controversial works, in particular works that are published by Catholics, by Jesuits in this period. They really do try and hunt down the anonymous authors of those works, and they are brought to account, and they are, you know, tried and hanged, drawn and quartered for publishing their works.
Take my name, I don't need it. Nothing stays the same anyway. Take my fame, I can't use it. My girlfriend calls me lame. Game was over yesterday. Tell me what's my name. Tell me what's my name. What's my name? We'll be right back. way it used to be. You slapped my face, but I got to say it. You never would have drank my coffee if I had never served you cream. Now tell me what you'll make.
My name from Prince, described by my producer Alex as getting very artistic there. So we're going to move the clock forward a bit for the next segment of the discussion and turn to Tom and the sort of American context of some of this. And it seems to me the obvious place to, or one of the obvious places to start in thinking about sort of anonymity in the press and engagements with issues of policy is the anonymous article signed Mr. X. That comes out in the journal Foreign Affairs in 1947 in relation to the conduct of the Soviet Union. So perhaps we should start by talking about who Mr. X actually was.
So Mr. X is probably one of the worst kept secrets in American kind of publishing kind of Cold War history, because ironically who Mr. X is broken within 2 days of the Foreign Affairs piece being published. But Mr. X is one of the most important American kind of diplomats, I think, that kind of sets the architecture for the Cold War, and that's George Kennan. George Kennan himself is an absolutely fascinating figure, because I think through him we can read a lot about what's going on with American foreign policy, not just during World War II, but also between really setting up the Cold War conflict and specifically the language in which we use to talk about the Cold War and this notion of containment, which I think many of our listeners would have kind of heard before, but I think it's worth kind of going in thinking specifically about the person who created this terminology, which in many ways defines the Cold War. So Kennan is fascinating for a number of reasons. He's born 1904 in Wisconsin. He's born to kind of fairly rural Midwest family. He's someone who spends time in his childhood in Germany and picks up one of the kind of really important traits that's going to make him so influential when it comes to the shaping and kind of becoming positioned as this kind of expert on foreign policy. He learns German for the first time. He attends Princeton, gets a degree in history, as all good students should do. But as someone who's kind of quite put off by his time in kind of this Eastern elite institution, he's someone who kind of feels kind of quite out of step with the academic circle. So he does something that I think is really critical at this point, which he joins the very, very newly formed US Foreign Service. And the things that he does as soon as he's kind of part of the kind of diplomatic corps is he's someone who spends an incredible amount of time in Europe. And he's someone who, and you kind of read these beautiful biographies that are written on him. John Lewis Gaddis's biography of him is, I think, the most exceptional and detailed study. But Kennan is someone who spends a lot of time in Europe, both in Yugoslavia, both in Germany, both in Moscow as well, at this truly transitional period in the 1930s in European history. And he's someone who picks up languages. He's someone who is learning constantly about the culture. He's someone who is, when the United States actually open up diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, which isn't until 1933. So it's the first time we're seeing kind of American diplomats going over to actually think about this newly formed Soviet Union. Kennan's there. Kennan's there right at the forefront. He's someone who witnesses the Stalinist purges and does what any good diplomat or foreign ambassador does. He starts to write about it. He starts to think about it. He starts to try and understand it. And this is where the origins of his initial report, which is called The Long Telegram, comes from. So whilst he's serving in Moscow, he writes his opinion, really, on what he calls trying to describe the nature of the Soviet Union, both as a newly kind of forming nation, but also kind of how they interpret and view the world. And he sends this back to the Secretary of Defense, James Forrester, at that time, and it is something of a smash hit. What Kennan is doing when he's kind of talking about the nature of the Soviet Union is he's kind of trying to describe and give a new understanding of what exactly the Soviet Union is, and more specifically, what its plans might be after World War II. And he introduces these new terminology that many foreign policymakers at the time are thinking about, because the big issue that America faces following World War II is what to actually do with its troops that are in occupied parts of Europe. Should people stay in places like Berlin? It's very expensive, and GIs who've gone over and served in World War II want to go home. So the question is, as soon as you start to remove troops, what happens to these nations? What happens to this kind of European country that's completely ripped apart by war? And Kennan starts introducing what I think is really important with his initial long telegram, which is this idea of a language of the Soviet Union, not necessarily simply described by military power, but in terms of psychology and, in many ways, ideology as well. And he starts describing in this kind of long telegram this idea that the Soviet Union and communism itself is a disease. And I think that's the most important aspect to what he's arguing here, this perception that the Soviet Union is, by its very nature, an expansionist nation. It's always going to expand. It starts to kind of think about the nature that America needs a new approach to how to kind of deal with the Soviet Union beyond just simply military might, but something that is more ethereal, something that's more kind of cultural as well. So he writes this back, and it's a bit of a smash hit. The way it comes published as kind of this Mr. X article, there's a lot of different kind of historical perceptions on this. The kind of, I think, the most convincing argument to be made by Frank Costigiglia when he kind of talks extensively about the origins of this Mr. X article, because it is a really badly kept secret. It's the fact that at the moment, the US State Department and the US kind of Foreign Affairs are looking for a language that they can use to explain to the American public how the United States should respond to the kind of, or how they should perceive the Soviet Union potentially as a threat. So when it kind of, so he sends this telegram back, James Forrester gives him permission to get it published in Foreign Affairs. Now, Foreign Affairs at that point is a pretty niche publication. It's got a readership, I've looked at the top today, about 19,000. So it's not exactly being read massively. But Kennan kind of publishes this piece, and initially, there's not really that much reaction. He publishes it under Mr. X. However, the two big organisations that pick up on this kind of little anonymous op-ed and make it massive are the Washington Post and the New York Times. Specifically, Arthur Crook, who is who's the kind of one of the syndicated journalists from the New York Times, who actually reads a draft of the article written by Kennan, not signed by Mr. X, but actually with George Kennan's name on it. So everyone knows who's written this thing. The Alsop brothers, who are kind of another two very important syndicated journalists for the Washington Post, also get wind of this. And what they do is they publicise it, they push it, to the right of the forefront of what American mainstream readers are engaging with. And that's really how it becomes quite famous and creates quite a stir when it first comes out.
So there is there a reason why, I mean, does Kennan intend to stay anonymous? Because it seems like it's a very badly kept secret. And I'm wondering if is there something to do with how government officials are seen as needing to interact with the public?
There is this kind of sense, and because when Kennan comes back from his time in Moscow and forms part of the new kind of national security policy, this kind of new outfits that come, there is this sense, even when it comes to stuff like the RAND Corporation they're going to found afterwards, that they do need to be kind of kept distant. It can't be government officials telling the American public what to think, but it can come out through other means. I mean, I think one of the most important things about this is how quickly they abandon this idea that Kennan could be kept secret. And Kennan himself starts in some ways later on in life, especially when he's being interviewed extensively, because he lives through the consequences of his policy of containment. So containment links to Vietnam, links to the Korean War. He's someone who starts to kind of regret quite extensively this idea that he is the person who's been attached to this terminology of how to respond to the Soviet Union. That in many ways, I think, which is quite fascinating about it, he thinks it's kind of been misused in some form or another.
So again, there's a loss of control of the debate in a kind of way.
I mean, what Kennan says specifically is that the United States should only be involved in certain what they call important countries. So they'd say Germany, Japan, these places the United States should be involved in, but places that are on the periphery that they think aren't that important potentially to American national security, such as places like Southeast Asia or Indochina. Kennan is very vocal about if we get involved in that in some form, there's going to be a huge problem for us down the line. And as soon as he publishes his piece in Foreign Affairs, you've got very famous American commentators like Walter Lippmann immediately saying, like, actually, if you look and read this, it's a monstrous document. I think the one important thing to mention here about the sources of Soviet conduct, it's beautifully written. Kennan is a wonderful writer. The language that he uses is really problematic from contemporary standpoints, the way it kind of personifies what the Soviet Union communism is. But it's an incredibly powerful piece to read, I think.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is whether it links, whether it's sort of starting something in terms of interactions, you know, a change in interactions between government and the press. Because I was starting to wonder whether you're kind of starting off in sort of 46, 47 with the sort of foreign affairs people, the diplomats, thinking that, you know, we need to start engaging with the public perhaps in a different way than we have before, but that perhaps over time you then get into scenarios where that starts to move to sort of more of a culture of leaks and, you know, papers getting out that in fact the administrations of the time would prefer not to have.
I think that's a really lovely way to kind of frame it, because I think what we're going to see after Kennan kind of working with the press extensively in some ways to kind of make sure that this constructed and very kind of deliberate vision of foreign policy is being presented, we're then going to see in the 70s, especially in the kind of 60s as well, a series of leaks that completely destroyed this perception of what America is really doing overseas. And the most famous ones, of course, are Danny Ellsberg with the Pentagon Papers, which again get published in two newspapers who are critical in pushing Kennan's view forward, which is the Washington Post and the New York Times. And of course, the big example we're going to be ending up with is the Bob Woodward and the Carl Bernstein publications around Watergate specifically, which, as kind of some of the listeners might know, it's one of the most important stories of the decade. And again, it's this kind of constant contentious relationship about how the president can manage press perceptions, and especially the idea of how specifically the editors or the owners of these very important kind of mouthpieces of American public opinion can resist or battle what the president wants them to be thinking at certain times.
Say
So we're turning for the next part of the programme tonight to talk to Jason. And one of the things we were talking about beforehand is the change in culture that seems to have gone on in the States, particularly with relation you were suggesting to the sort of culture of leaks. And we were talking a moment ago about the sort of Nixon period. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about that.
Yes, I'm picking what you've just said there, the change in culture barely begins to describe what's happened in the past 2 years with the present incumbent at the White House. It's more that culture has been picked up and kicked out the front door, and an entirely new relationship set in place, which certainly in my lifetime I've never seen with regard to mainstream media in the developed world. It's kind of interesting to pick up in part over from the comments we were making in terms of the investigations that took place into Nixon and the anonymous tip-offs that took place there. The principal difference that seems to be happening on a regular basis in the White House under the Trump administration is in terms of a series of leaks coming from within the White House on a regular basis and the reasons why these are taking place. A very, very simple and straightforward approach to this is the fact that Trump clearly was not prepared for the presidency and brought with him an extremely amateur team, in part because, particularly in the early stages of his presidency, the Republican machinery itself seemed to be keeping its distance from the president who had won the election against all the odds. So, to put it as politely as possible, Trump surrounded himself with amateurs, and this particularly came through in terms of his inability to control the messaging that was coming from within the White House. My favourite example from July 2017 is Anthony Scaramucci, who, you know, the shortest lived director of communications, I think, in the history of the White House, which was a source of incredible regret to me. I was looking forward to a many long years of Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch, as he became known, revealing far too much about what was happening and threatening, you know, to do unspeakable atrocities against the various traitors and leakers that were in the White House. The key illustration of this, which isn't exactly anonymity, but Scaramucci failing to understand the relations between the White House and the press, is when he contacts Ryan Christopher Lietzer, who at that point is writing for The New Yorker before moving to CNN, to unload on him, you know, his difficulties with Steve Bannon, with privacy, etc., that all the other figures that he just unleashes this verbiage, this torrent of abuse, and then halfway through the conversation kind of goes, this is off the record, isn't it? And of course, none of it was off the record. It's all published. It's all enters into the public sphere very, very quickly. And within 10 days, Anthony Scaramucci's out of a job. And that's just symptomatic. It's emblematic of the complete failure to control messaging that takes place in the first months and indeed years of President Trump's administration. So I've suggested that a fundamental error that takes place in the relations with the press come from amateurish behaviour, the fact that Trump has not really appointed a team that can work effectively, that has the experience of working with what can be actually a very aggressive press corps. And we've seen this recently. I mean, on a personal level, for me, it's kind of interesting watching some of the White House correspondents, the press corps there, and how they behave, particularly obviously with Acosta recently being banned. And I've actually been extremely ambivalent about that particular incident. Having his press pass removed, an attempt to crudely control the press, is clearly something I'm not in favour of. But it's also clear that because of the failings of the White House's press communications department, that you do, I think, you do plenty of times have mainstream media grandstanding. They are looking to stoke a story, which I can't remember who it was now. You know, it may not be good for America, but it's certainly good for CNBC or something like CBS. And we see elements of this, of the story constantly being provoked. The anonymous editorial that you began the programme with was an astonishing failure of journalism, to be entirely honest, on the part of the New York Post. I mean, simply giving this anonymous op-ed such a privileged position without the means for interrogation, without the means for discussion. This was not Deep Throat bringing down the state. This was somebody clearly part of the administration looking out for their back. And actually for the press to so regularly get involved in the pantomime, which is communications within the White House, is extremely problematic for journalism as it happens at the moment. But the final point I just wanted to make with regard to this was that whilst there's an amateurish element in terms of the White House dealings with the press, it also has its roots in actually what was a very canny strategy for comms by Trump during the primaries in particular, and indeed during the election to a lesser degree, which was what was really important for Trump was to be the news cycle, was to dominate the news cycle. And so, you know, there literally was no news that was bad news for President Trump. For Trump as a candidate in the primaries. If he could dominate the news cycle, that meant that, you know, the potential voters didn't even know who the other candidates were. So, you know, that infamous phrase that he could, you know, shoot somebody in New York and he wouldn't lose a single vote. In terms of that attention, in terms of the sheer value of that, so the fact that he didn't need to spend particularly much money at all on advertising to just get his name up there, this was a lesson that he learned very quickly and obviously brought with him from TV and just being Donald Trump, for God's sake. He brought this lesson with him. And didn't realise that actually, if you want to run an administration, if you actually want to implement policies, if you actually want to create something even vaguely approaching a legacy, then actually discipline, control of that message is actually an incredibly important part. And to end with a final comparison. We have leak after leak coming out of the White House, but the Mueller investigation continues to surprise with affidavits and arrests taking place that nobody seems to know until the morning that they happen. That is discipline.
I was going to ask you, though, I mean, do you think, I wonder how much, to give a counter-argument, how much it matters the indiscipline in the sense of whether it speaks to whether this whole thing speaks in different ways to the changing nature of the media now as opposed to earlier periods. And I was kind of thinking about it in several ways. One was that a lot of the figures who've come into the White House have come from sort of media backgrounds that are, as it were, non-traditional.
Yes.
These small websites, these fringe publications that seem to be emerging in an internet age when there's much more, on one level, much more freedom to publish and much fewer kind of checks on quality. And yet that often is able to, you're able to build up an audience and survive in that kind of world. And then, of course, the other side of that being, as you said, the grandstanding of journalists, and the push for ratings.
Yes.
And so that as long as there's a headline story that will get the clicks in the evening, on the evening Twitter feed or on the evening news, the sort of substance of it is perhaps obscured. I just wonder what your thoughts were.
So several things, actually. To answer your first question, does this matter? Actually, yes, it does. Whilst, the Senate, Trump is vaunting the fact that the Senate increased its majority, almost unheard of during midterm elections. He got a shellacking in the House. This was not a good result for Trump. And I think actually the chaos of that first 2 years seems to have had a drip effect outside of those deep red areas. So, many of the Midwest states that had gone for Trump over Clinton in the 2016 election, they are no longer so secure. And some of the blue states have gone a deeper shade of blue. I mean, famously, obviously, California now, where, Republicans are an endangered species. So I think it still does matter. And it matters not necessarily in the individual instances. It matters in a consistent series of messaging. And actually, one of the best examples of this is Hillary Clinton in the run-up to the 2016 election. The issues about her server, the mail server and the missing emails, Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. Actually, the Republicans were running a very canny strategy which made Hillary Clinton, over a long period of time, appeared deeply unreliable, deeply untrustworthy to the American public. So I think, actually, individual instances, probably not. But over a period of time, and we're talking, in Trump's case, 2 years, Hillary Clinton, actually, a longer period, you actually build up. People do not remember the individual instances, but they then just have this base reaction to particular individuals.
Everybody wants to know your name, to know your name.
Know Your Name, Lindsay Lohan. Maybe one day we will know the identity of this of the anonymous White House staff member whose publication in the New York Times Jason was deploring in the last segment. There was one point we were just coming to at the end of that last segment around this question of the changing media landscape and the sort of question of clickbait and so on. And I just wanted to give Jason a chance to come in on that.
So in response to that, I mean, your question wasn't just dealing with that simple question of controlling the message, but how this operates within a wider media landscape. And actually, I mean, I've just been writing about the effects of the changing nature of technology on journalism and its particular future. And a really simple base point, which everybody kind of knows, but I think most people, unless they're specifically studying the area, don't actually pay that much attention to, is the absolutely devastating decline of print. That particularly, I mean, and most organisations now have stopped actually counting, because the sort of organisations that were really concerned with auditing, they wanted to celebrate the growth of print so they could get in advertisers. And then when it became clear about 2012 that print was falling off a cliff and never coming back, they simply stopped keeping the records. It's fascinating. In some areas, we don't know how poor print circulation is. But with that becomes an absolute loss of revenue, that the print advertising industry, which actually fueled these beasts like the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc., that made them very rich and profitable entities, that has gone. And so what you find is that in an online environment, you mentioned small websites. I mean, Breitbart is a famous one that came out of nowhere to become a significant player in the Trump administration. What's become quite clear in the age of social media, in the age of not being able to rely upon traditional processes of editorial curation, that actually it's the headlines that will attract the most attention, that will get the most clicks. And this is actually, it's a trap very much that, you know, respectable publications have had to play. I'm not going to say they've fallen into trap. They have to play this to keep up the amount of interest in their stories so they can get readers. And this creates an increasingly, in some respects, a very often hysterical sense of journalism, particularly in America. I think actually in the UK, we've always had this. We have a very ignoble tabloid tradition that has run for many decades now. But in America, this was largely confined to the sidelines in the post-war period. I mean, actually, in some respects, some of the things I read today, they remind me much more of the yellow press of the late 19th and early 20th century. You know, literally the period that gave us muckraking as a technique. The changing economics of producing the news is transforming the practice of what people will do to get attention in this new digital age.
I want to give John a chance to come in, because one of the things I didn't get round to asking you when we were talking earlier is, to what extent is anybody making any money in your period from these publications, and how are they keeping afloat? As a sort of secondary and slightly different question to that, I was wondering to what extent, obviously they're trying to, we were talking just now about the issue of controlling the message, and you were mentioning the fairly vicious and brutal ways that various bodies of authority are trying to control the message in your period. And I just wondered, how far are they successful in stamping out what they regard as dangerous or heretical views? How far are they able to make that control stick?
Mm-hmm. I suppose the short answer to that is we don't actually know a lot of the time how some of these texts are funded. I mean, it is suspicious that some of these texts do get printed, and that's why we think they must be official, because why on earth would somebody be printing these as a commercial venture? You know, they're not really the sort of text that you'd immediately think people would be rushing out to buy, you know, really dry kind of policy statements on kind of economic affairs in the Tudor period. The second question, though, is a really interesting one about how do you control print. I mean, there is censorship at this time. There is an attempt to have pre-publication censorship. Things have to go through the censors, the government officials. But a lot of the time that is evaded, and printing presses are hid. In basements, because they're massive, you know, these are massive contraptions. People do print things abroad and have them shipped into the country. But also there's outside of print as well. Things are being circulated outside of print that are dangerous. And one of the sources that early modern historians look at quite a lot are things called libels, which are basically jokes and rhymes that circulate, not in print, but they circulate by word of mouth. And if anything, they're more dangerous for the government and its reputation than things that are appearing in print. Because, you know, they're attacking the king, they're joking about the king and his sexuality, for instance, and people are sharing these jokes in alehouses. And how can you police that? It's simply impossible to police what people are joking about over a flagon of ale, for instance. But that, over time, does have this kind of drip effect, like we've just heard with like Hillary Clinton. You know, it does kind of erode confidence in the monarchy. And I'm not saying the Civil War in England starts because people were joking about the king, but it doesn't help. You know, it doesn't help the image of the king in the 17th century that people are constantly joking about him behind his back.
I think it's really interesting. One thinks about it, print as being, you know, as having this really powerful and changing effect, and the idea that actually still, I mean, perhaps even today, still the sort of the word of mouth, the contempt, the sort of verbal contempt for authority can have as much impact as something that's actually written down. I wanted to come back to Tom. We're obviously, I mean, Jason was sort of arguing that he sees it as being, you know, really transformative what's happened in terms of the relations between Trump and the media in contrast to sort of earlier presidencies. And I wondered if you agreed with that, and also sort of what your prognosis would be about it, whether you see this as likely to, you know, can we go back to a more normal sort of relationship between the White House and the press? Has there ever been a normal relationship to go back to, do you think?
I don't think there's ever been a normal relationship between the White House and the press. I think, especially considering the rise of clickbait and these kind of smaller media sites, there's always going to be this kind of incredibly contentious relationship. One of the things that I was thinking about quite a lot when everyone was talking was this relationship between technology and the public and these kind of op-eds, because it's not just enough that the op-eds are being published on themselves. They're existing in an incredibly visual world at the moment. And I'm sorry to go back in time again, but Vietnam War, I think, is a huge transitional moment, not only because I gave a lecture on this week, so it's still in the back of my mind. But what I was thinking about is the power of the Pentagon Papers when Danny Ellsberg leaks them isn't just what the actual content and what the New York Times, Washington Post are doing. It's the fact that Walter Cronkite has gone on news saying that we've basically lost the war in Vietnam. And there's this quote kind of I was using this week about, you know, the idea that as soon as you kind of create a media landscape in which everything is completely uncensored, you're showing people everything that's going on. So it creates this kind of, the whole kind of mystique about the White House being on the side of the people, the politicians speak on the side of the people. It's been erupted since Nixon and the 60s. There's nothing particularly new about what Trump's doing. Think about the way that kind of the Lewinsky scandal was dealt with by Clinton as well. I don't think there's ever been a normalized relationship between the White House and the press, but I think what's really interesting is how we view the public within this kind of narrative as well. Considering with the recent midterm elections, how much Trump could dominate the news cycle and control the conversation, especially around the idea of the migrant caravan, that kind of the local issues that are going on about voter suppression and what's going on in places like Georgia and Texas seem to be completely lost from the narrative almost entirely. Predictions going forward? I don't know. I mean, I think it'll be really interesting to see how the Democrats try to manage the media landscape going forwards. And I think the big one we haven't talked about yet is Facebook, and the way that Facebook is kind of being part of the way that people are now engaging with types of news stories. I'm going to frame it very gently like that. But also the way that kind of social media and platforms like that are now almost taking away the traditional role that print media has had, because people, I'm going to generalise here, you've not necessarily gone to the BBC or The Guardian to read the latest things that are coming out. You go on Facebook, and the Facebook stories that are being created can be incredibly tailored for the audience on there already.
It's interesting to reflect just quickly. I mean, I'm not going to ask another question, because I'm aware that time, we have rushed to the end of another show. But it's interesting, that last point about the migrant caravan. I mean, I agree with you that there was that dominance of the news cycle, which has subsequently come in for quite a lot of criticism. Though the interesting thing seems to have been that at least at the House level, that didn't translate into
the Republicans surviving. And there was some quite interesting stuff about the idea that actually at more local level, it was other stories that were actually gaining traction. But I think we need to bring it to a conclusion there. Unfortunately, we can go on discussing some of these things for some time. But I'd like to thank my three guests this week, this month, Tom Bishop, John Fitzgibbons, and Jason Whittaker. I'd also, as usual, like to thank Alex Efchuk for keeping the show on the road and looking after all the music and the technical stuff and all of that. I am Dr. Finn Pollard, and Past Prologue will be back, we hope, in about a month's time. There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating. Newspapers shout, a new style is growing, but it don't